Hey guys, we're back. It's Smart Brand Marketing. I have a very special guest for you guys, because you all know him. It's Rand Fishkin from SEO Moz, and he wrote a book called Lost and Founder, and we'll talk about some of that today, and a new project. I think it's pronounced SparkToro. Is it, Rand?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, cool.
Yes.
So I looked at that too. It looks very mysterious. So I'm not actually sure what that's about. So I'll ask Rand about that too. But the main topic here, and this is something I've been having conversations about for the last few months with so many people, it's escaping the services hamster wheel. Because a lot of us are doing services. A lot of us are seeing people having crazy exits with products or SaaS or... well, some of them are getting their accounts shut down on Amazon doing FBA, but it's still not services, right? So it's this going narrow versus going broad idea, right? So like having six really good clients that you're like emotionally attached to, or having customers where you don't know what they're doing and, you know, money comes in when you sleep. So I know a lot of service owners are trying to get to, you know, the one that we're all in now, to kind of what you pulled off. So I'm interested in talking about that.
Yeah, sounds good. Obviously, my book, you know, in the chapter you mentioned makes the case that services are actually pretty awesome. And I would encourage a lot more people to think services rather than product. But yes, I agree with you that the common misconception is that, you know, product is much sexier and product businesses do better. I think the market is sort of finally waking up to the idea that maybe that's not entirely true. And even a lot of product businesses are now becoming very services, I wouldn't say focused, but services in addition to product for both their revenue and how they keep their customers.
Yeah, so when I started reading the chapter, right, like in the first you made a really good case for the products. Right. With some caveats, you know, like you did mention to have a competitive differentiator that you need an audience. And that kind of stuck with me, too. You know, like you guys actually had from the side hustle 1,000 people coming to your blog every single day, which, you know, makes it easier to go broad, you know, than someone that has like a blog with maybe 500 people, which you can build a really good services business around, but it's just not enough for that push, you know, to go products. But at the end, you did make that case for services, which like completely made me confused. I'm like, you're right. I am making a lot of profit. I don't know. Since you read that, you know, wrote that book, I'm curious about some more thoughts on this because, you know, it's so sexy in the magazines for everyone to, you know, go SaaS, get investors. But you made a really good case for why that's not always the right way to go.
Yeah. I mean, so my network includes, you know, a lot of founders who have built product-based businesses and many who have gone the software route. And I know a lot of folks who've raised institutional capital, so venture, private equity, those sorts of things, and many folks who've raised alternative forms of capital, whether that's, you know, friends and family or some more alternative investment types of things like Indie VC and Tiny Seed Fund, which my wife and I are investors in. And I so I have this sort of broad perspective across many folks. And I think the statistics that I quoted in Lost and Founder bear this out pretty nicely. Basically, services businesses tend to have a five-year survival rate and a long-term success rate that is higher than the average, at least in the United States. So higher than the average small business. Your odds of surviving five or more years are in the 60 to 70%, depending on the year and the cohort. If you are a services business, right, a consultancy, an agency, that kind of thing. If you're a product-based business and you have raised or attempted to raise venture, your five-year survival odds are about between 10 and 15%. So I think that you're right. The, you know, whatever, magazines, blogs, media make it seem very sexy, but in fact, the failure rate is 5 to 10 times higher for product-based businesses that try and raise venture versus service-based businesses, which almost never do. And that is pretty spooky, right? I think the weird thing to realize is, you know, when your friend raises a round of venture, the usual thing that we all say is, congratulations. And I think it means congratulations with an asterisk, you're probably going to die now. Your company's probably dead, right?
Yeah,
9 times out of 10.
This is interesting that you mentioned that. And I want to get your take on this because I really don't know much about the venture world. You know, I'm mostly in services. Sure. Anything I've done is bootstrapping. And I think a lot of my listeners, too, they think, I'll get 10%, get a silent investor, which I don't think that's going to work because no investor is going to give you just 10% for nothing. Mm-hmm. So there was this example, right? A friend of mine, he went to San Francisco. He had an AI idea. I'm just not going to say what it is, just, you know. But it's just an AI idea. He said he met with like 30 different investors. Four of them invested within 30 minutes. He got $400K to build this thing. And everyone was saying, you know, congrats, just like you said. But what's the reality of something like that? If you just come with an idea and you get $400K, what's that usually look like in reality?
Well, first off, generally speaking, your friend probably either has an excellent network or superb selling skills.
Probably both.
And maybe both. Mm-hmm. It is very, very challenging to get into the world of raising money in Silicon Valley or out of it. And it is very network driven, right? When a lot of the analyses look at, hey, you know, why is it that more men named John or more venture dollars flowed to men named John in the last 5 years than to all women combined? Mm-hmm. You know, there's obviously bias, right? There's certainly sexism and institutional bias and individual bias, but I think there's also these network effects at play, which is, very frustrating. I think it's tremendously difficult if you are from rural northern Canada and know mostly people in your hometown to go to Silicon Valley and raise money, because getting on people's radar, getting the connections that you need, you know, having people say, oh yeah, you, this person is excellent and you should like them and trust them and I like them and trust them, that's a really, really hard thing to do. So that first part that your friend accomplished is remarkable and extremely unusual, right? For every founder who ends up raising even a few $100,000, there are 500 founders, 1,000 founders who never make it.
Okay.
Who never even get that far. And then the second thing is, once you raise what's generally now called a seed round, right? A few $100,000, maybe $1 million, $1.5 million from individual angels, your odds of getting venture funding, again, you know, you go through the funnel, it looks generally like 10 to 15%, sometimes as high as 20%, depending on the sector and the year, will be able to raise venture after their seed round. So seed investors expect that 1 in 5 to 1 in 10, maybe even as low as 1 in 20 of their investments will be able to raise venture and survive and keep going. Most of the rest are going to fail entirely and not return any money. Some small percentage of those might sell or be acqui-hired, you know, go onto a team and be able to repay their investors with, you know, not a lot of profit.
The one thing that you mentioned in the book, and I'm kind of curious how it, you know, relates to this, is when you said that having a services business, the owner will actually make much more money, right? Because you can take the profit and things like that. With an investment thing like that, like you yourself said, working with Moz and making 48 or something million a year, like you didn't make much money because you had a salary.
Yeah, I made my salary, which was a nice salary, but it was below market for, you know, my position and role and the size of company. I think, almost every other executive at Moz out-earns what I did there, most of them by a considerable margin. And, you know, your compensation as founder that your investors and board will take into account how much ownership you have in the company. And so cash that you actually get out is essentially below market until or unless you have an exit. And again, you know, the stats on that are pretty, pretty public. 95% of venture invested companies fail to return their invested, their minimum multiple, right, to return money to the fund, which is usually 3 to 5 times the investment. And about, let's say, 85 to 90% return nothing at all. So for most founders, for the overwhelming majority of founders, even after they raise venture, they're going to be, generally speaking, compensated less than what their market rate would be, right? Less than what they'd get if they went to some big or medium-sized company or, open their own agency or consultancy. But it's a lottery ticket, right? And I think that's the right way to think about it. The right way to think about it is, hey, if I think I am in the 5% of, founders in this incredibly competitive field who not only can raise money, but then, build a business that's going to be acquired or go public, this is my lottery ticket. And if you end up doing that and you do a good job of negotiating with your investors along the way, and you're in a strong position to negotiate along the way, you can, make millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
It's very uncommon.
Yeah. What I was curious about is when you start taking an investment like this, like you did with Moz, or, some people do in the Silicon Valley, it seems like you move from, like, I can take as much profit as I feel like, to some kind of a structured salary. And now, I think it just feels different.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. So you basically will get your salary, which you can negotiate with your board about, although generally speaking, it is frowned upon for founders to negotiate very hard on that. Boards generally view it as, hey, if this founder really believes in this company, the founder will be happy to take a much reduced salary in exchange for the long term, to sort of success. They're in this for the long term. They don't mind being hungry and underpaid for the next 5, 10, 15 years, because after that, they're going to be wealthy if the company does well.
Yeah. So I think, like you said, it's a lottery thing. So that does make a better case for a service business where, you pretty much get paid what you're worth.
Generally speaking, I mean, the beautiful thing about services, and I have a lot of friends who run services businesses, who've sold services businesses, right, and done very well from that, is that it is much more in your hands, right? So I think that let's put aside the issue of independently funded or alternatively funded product businesses, and let's go with just the classic sort of venture style product businesses. It is usually the case that a venture style product business is going to have, a lot of capital requirements versus a services business where you don't have capital requirements, right? You don't need a lot of investment, if any, to get off the ground. You can, generally speaking, start the thing from home as it scales up and you get more clients and people are paying and willing to pay and your network grows and more of your customers and clients are willing to recommend you and introduce you to their associates. Yeah, you can, grow, build an office. You can do all of this profitably and sustainably. You can hire and fire at will. Your growth rate is not particularly concerning to you. If you're growing at 20% year over year, you're fine. If you're growing at 50 or 100, you're thrilled. If you're growing at negative 5%, okay, well, you got to work a little harder. In the venture world, it is a totally different, different thing. If just a few years of lack of growth can be completely deadly to your business short and long term. And often for a lot of founders, their mental health as well.
Yeah, I could imagine that. What do you think of this new trend of creating productized services, right? So that's going from, high-end clients to just having sort of customers who spend maybe $500 either per month or just one time on something, and you also don't talk to them, So this could be like one of my friends had the WP Curve, which was just WP WordPress customer service type thing, so they would just do things like there's a lot of like unlimited designs, things like that, which I'm seeing pop up too. I would like to get your take on those.
Yeah, I like it. I think that for a lot of services businesses, adding an element of product or productizing your service such that it becomes more of a similar workflow each time, similar process each time. It's easier to put through a process and have that be the outcome. I think that is terrific, right? I think that that can be game changing for you. And likewise, if you have a product business and you are finding that, gosh, when we do some more handholding, provide some more services, give a representative who's sort of, you know, on call and working with our clients, you know, and we treat them a little more like clients than like just buyers or subscribers, boy, that seems to have a really positive impact on retention and on lifetime value. Absolutely, you should go for that, right? What's stopping you? The only thing that historically has been stopping folks on the product side from doing that and going more in the services world is that investors are so anti-services revenue, right? They look at a revenue spread. I detailed this in the book, how I pitched investors, and they looked at Moz. This was maybe 2008, right, 2009. And they said, gosh, you know, you're still 20%, 30% services revenue. We don't really believe that you're a product business, so we don't want to invest.
Interesting.
And of course, that ended up meaning that I think Moz did a very, very dumb thing, dropped services entirely, right, got rid of our services businesses, and moved to a model where we refused to do even light customer service style onboarding, right? Until, what, 10 years later when we finally picked it up again and said, oh, wait a minute, maybe this was a good idea after all. I think that really hurt the company's prospects and ability to build relationships and to learn from its customers. And that was a dumb bias, right? We should have not listened to potential investors who didn't actually put money into us and instead trusted our gut and our customers. I think that's the way a lot of these things are, right? If the media is amplifying something, if it seems like there's all these people making all this money doing something, you try and emulate it rather than forging your own path.
Why do you think the investors are so anti-services?
They don't like the revenue multipliers at sale time. Right. So when there's an IPO or when there's a valuation in a public offering or an acquisition, services revenue tends to get treated as having a higher sort of cash discount rate, cash flow discount rate than product revenue. And so they don't like the multipliers on that. And, you know, generally speaking, that's because Wall Street doesn't like the multipliers on that, although Wall Street has been more forgiving than private investors have been, especially the last 5-10 years. So it's a little weird.
You know, when you mentioned in the book about the tool that you guys first put out, it was something that you used for your own company and then simply offered it to the public. And I've seen the few successful products like that my friends had, it was always the same case. It was something that they made for themselves. A few of them, you know, just bootstrapped it, offered it to the public, made a good exit. I don't see as much of that for a service business that's creating a new product instead of just like, you know, like you did, having something they already used. What do you think someone that is in a services business should be doing if they want to get into product service, unless, you know, if they don't have something that they're already using for themselves and to hopefully make it successful?
Yeah, I think, well, let's see. I would say there is a range of options again, right? I think that you can... Let me frame it a different way. I think the right decision is the one that is right for you and the way that you work best and what your customers need, right? And what your market needs. And I think that those should dictate things probably more so than whatever prevailing investor preferences or market, you know, stock market or sale market types of things. I think optimizing for those is less ideal, generally speaking.
So let me reframe it then. Like, what steps would you take? Let's say you have a services business, right? You don't have a mm-hmm. tool like that. Do you start testing different ideas and maybe try doing like, you know, validate through sales pages? Do you start building an audience? Because you guys had the audience, right? So is that the key to the first? Yeah. Like, what would you, you know, tell yourself like back then, like if you did not have this stuff, like go build an audience first or, you know, I'm just curious.
Right. That's exactly my advice, both in Lost and Founder and broadly speaking, is that I think that it is far easier to get either a product or a services business off the ground. It's not the only way to do it, but it is far easier to do it if you have first built up your expertise and leverage that expertise to build a network and leverage that network to build an audience. And that audience can come from, you know, you could be maybe you're a great blogger. Maybe you do, maybe you're great at social media. Maybe you're great at building an email list. Maybe you're great at video marketing on YouTube. Maybe you are really good at visuals on, you know, whatever it is, Instagram and Dribbble and Behance and those kinds of places. Maybe you have great podcasting skills and you've built up your audience that way. Whatever it is, I am urging and I would urge folks to build their audience first, because everything becomes much easier if you have a group of people who know you, like you, trust you, and care about what you're doing, and they follow you. And therefore, when you build things, you can, you know, test out those things, right? You can determine whether this is the thing that your audience needs, this is what resonates with them or doesn't.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people also fail during the building audience stage, you know, and I find that it's like so scary when someone just comes up to me and, you know, I'm like, so what do you do? And I'm building an audience, without having anything to sell on the back end yet, because they're only building an audience, you know? So I mean,
the nice part, I'm not going to say it's easy, but the nice part about it is when you build an audience with nothing to sell, your motivations become very pure. And the perception of your motivations is very pure, right? So if you are, why are you building an audience? Well, eventually I'm going to have something. But today, my entire goal is just be valuable to these people. How can I help this group of people succeed in whatever it is they want to do? How can I be interesting and engaging and valuable to them? And I have nothing to sell them. And so therefore, I don't have conflict of interest. I can get on stage and present and no one accuses me of being self-promotional because I'm just helping other people, right? And then as you build that audience, now you can build things for them. And as you determine what they need, be more self-promotional and have people who already care about you and are engaged with you.
Yeah, out of all the cases that I've seen, only one became a success. And it was like a week from going bankrupt, came up with an idea that finally hit after like 30 ideas that didn't. But he spent like a year and a half, I think, before creating an audience. The other few all went back to regular jobs and they just said, this is not it. But what you've done is you did have a business and the building the audience was more of a side hustle. From what I remember in the book.
Interesting. Sort of, right? We had a sort of failing web design business. And then the audience building was started as a professional hobby kind of website frustration thing, and then eventually turned into, we're getting clients who are asking for business, you know, asking us to do work through this. I guess our business is becoming mostly SEO instead of web design now. And then we built a product, a software product, right, to serve that same audience because it was something we ourselves needed. And yeah, from there it scaled up. But, with SparkToro, I'm doing this in a sort of similar fashion, right? We built an audience, have been building an audience for the last 18 months, and hopefully early next year we'll be launching a product for that. group.
Do you have a method for the moments in every business person's life when you have to make one or two really big decisions, right? So, you know, taking investors on or not. Do we start a blog or not? Do we go productized or do we stick with the services? Do you have any method for figuring out which choice you're going to make?
Let's see. I think that personal passion plays a big role in this, right? So I think it's a little less strategic and a little bit more emotional than we all want to believe, right? There's especially this, you know, belief that, well, you know, in business, we're supposed to be logical and economically driven. And that's just not the case. We can try and kid ourselves, but it just isn't. What in fact I think is happening and what most of us do is we post hoc justify it and say, well, it was the logical decision for us to do X or Y or Z. But I think it's okay to embrace the fact that this is an emotional and a personal decision and kind of a life decision for the founder more than anything else. And if you, you know, for example, don't mind the odds of the product business or you feel like, hey, that's where my passion is, that's where my interest is, that's what I'm going to have more fun doing. I think because I'm going to have more fun and more passion around it, I'll be more successful at it. Great. Give it a go. If you are someone who is very, you know, you're worried about whether it'll work, you can experiment with it. I know tons of services businesses that have experimented with product. They've dipped their toe in. Some of them have found that the water is just fine and they go all in on it and they run both services and product businesses, or they run productized services businesses, or they drop their services businesses like we did and go full product. And some who find that the water is terrible and they jump right out and they shut off the product thing and say, you know what, services is for me. I'm going to stick with it.
You know, I'm also curious about your audience building now with SparkToro. Because, you know, you've been writing about SEO for a long, long time. So what are you guys doubling down on? Is it content creation and hoping the SEO will hit? Is it paid traffic at all? Is it social media? How are you guys figuring out the channels to really go through?
Yeah, we are actually building up much less SEO focused than what I did with Moz. And that's for a variety of reasons. But one of the big ones is that I am nervous long-term about the relative value and ability of Google to drive traffic. I think Google is becoming a place where they are trying to send more and more traffic back to Google's own properties, and they're consuming a lot of the click opportunities. And also, I think that the more we put effort into product and tool building, things that are sort of consistently useful to our audience, the more we're going to find that those things get amplified. So I have been playing in a lot of the marketing channels, organic marketing channels. So that would include things like, you know, doing a lot of interviews and press stuff. I do a lot of speaking, public speaking. I get invited to a lot of events and use those to, you know, sort of continue to build and maintain an audience. Social media, Twitter and LinkedIn in particular, are pretty big for me because they're big for web marketers and that's our audience. I have less success with, but still continue to make efforts with Facebook. We do some content marketing, you know, on our blog and with a few resources on the SparkToro site. So I would say we're trying to play a pretty diversified traffic game and not be too dependent on any one channel rather than going all in on something. I'm not sure that I would urge everyone to do that, but because I have an existing audience and, you know, had done this before, I'm pretty good at hitting these different channels for distribution and awareness.
Yeah, when I went on SparkToro, I've seen the graph that you guys put out that around 50% of the searches on Google now result in no action whatsoever. And that scared me too.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was that high. I thought maybe 20 or 30%, but that's really Google showing It's like a sandbox now. It's not really a search engine anymore. And it's, I don't know if I would. So I keep meeting with people in the affiliate space, right? And they still, you know, put out these, I always say just crappy sites with Amazon links. I know they say they're great blogs, but it's just crappy sites. And I find that with all these things, like, you know, especially with Google, like the arbitrage is getting much harder. You know, like before it was like, okay, I'm going to take the traffic and redirect it. But with Google now, like it seems like they don't want us to get any traffic soon. Like they want to keep all the traffic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's a bias in Google to, you know, if you're building a low quality affiliate site, even a high quality affiliate site, but it's not a very well-known brand or you're not building a brand, they don't want you in the results, right? They feel like you're polluting the web and harming their ecosystem rather than helping it. So they're going to do everything they can to take traffic away from you. And I think that's fighting an uphill battle. There's other traffic opportunities, but I think there's also more opportunities to build different kinds of things, right? Instead of, you know, numerous low to medium quality affiliate sites. I think the affiliate model, frankly, is in long-term danger. I wouldn't say short-term. I think there's going to be plenty of opportunity, plenty of people who make money on it for the next 3 to maybe even 10 years. But the major players of the web and the mindset of most consumers is moving significantly away from it. I think that's just a reality we sort of have to deal with.
You know, the last thing I wanted to ask you is you went from a kind of failing web design company to building something that's, I mean, known to everyone, you know, which is Moz, and now the next company. So there's been a lot of ups and downs, right? What do you sort of do during the highs and the lows, right? Because there's moments where you feel like, yay, this is like the best thing in the world. And then there are moments where like, oh man, like, I don't know if I can get to tomorrow, right? So both are a bit dangerous, you know, like if you're too optimistic or too pessimistic, you know, how do you deal with those two moments when you go through them? Because you've been through some of these cycles already.
I would definitely say one of the nice things about going through the cycles so many times is that you find an internal tenor that helps the highs feel less high and the lows feel less low. Part of that is age, right? Age and experience. I think, you know, you just find that as you get into your 40s and 50s instead of your 20s and 30s, that things that felt really big in your life don't feel as big. And some of that is sad, right? Some of that is a loss of the excitement and the crazy optimism. And some of it is really wonderful, right? Because it, as bad as things get, you know, you sort of know that, well, tomorrow I'm going to wake up and it's going to be another day and the world is still working and it'll be okay, right? As long as I'm sort of healthy and my friends and family and the people that I love and care about are healthy and happy, things are okay, right? And I think that you change a little bit of your mentality around goals as well. So one of the one of the things that I felt very desperate about through all of my 20s and probably a lot of my 30s as well was I felt that if I didn't make Moz a company that, you know, returned my 5 to 10x to my investors and had a huge sale or an IPO, that I was a failure, like as a human being, that my entire life was a failure if I didn't do that one thing. And then, of course, you know, over time you realize, I certainly realize that, no, that's not true at all, right? My marriage is actually a much bigger part of my life than Moz is or was. The people that are around me, friends and family, people I care about, that matters a lot more. I think it's those kinds of perspectives that you gain over time that help you through those times. But In addition to those, I would urge folks to do some tactical things, right? Every founder, no matter how old you are. First off, one of the things that can help with high highs and low lows is sleep. When you are sleep deprived and you're not getting enough of it, the lows feel crazy low, the highs feel crazy high. That is generally a negative thing, and sleep is the thing that is best correlated with strong mental health and being able to weather psychological storms and emotional storms. The second one is have people to talk to, right? Build a network of other founders who care about you, who you care about, who you can lean on. My wife does this with writers. She's an author, and she has a bunch of other authors and writers that she regularly talks to, and they help each other through things. I do it with entrepreneurs and friends in the web marketing space. You know, I'm on several email lists like this. And the third thing that I would urge everyone to do, if you can, is to take care of your health, right? So that means diet and exercise and going to the doctor and generally caring for your body. You care for your body, and your body will care for your mind.
Thank you. I think that was a good way to finish this up. Rand, where can people find you?
I am at sparktoro.com. So feel free to check out our website, and you can see what we're building there. If you want to follow my regular updates, I'm most active on Twitter, where I'm at Randfish.
Yeah, I recommend following that account. I just did, and Rand is creating a tweet storm every week, it seems like. I think it's over 40 tweets, right? Every single week. Are you doing it yourself, or do you have someone scheduling it or helping you out? Because that's a lot of tweets to just put out.
No, I manage my own social entirely. I've never used a scheduling tool or an admin or anything for stuff like that.
Interesting. Okay, thank you again.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Before you go, let me know if you enjoyed this interview. Leave a review, subscribe, join the Smart Brand Marketing Facebook page, whatever is easiest. Also, if you need my help marketing your online course, or know that your business could use some SEO, come to smartbrandmarketing.com, check out the case studies, and reach out to me. Once again, smartbrandmarketing.com. Until next time.